In the 1870s in western New York, by a beautiful lake, something got started that was called the Chautauqua Society. And it became sort of a traveling, learning, annex, edutainment function that traveled all over the country. And people like the Jubilee Singers and Brit Shakespeare Companies and female prison reformers and humorists would travel all over the country, and it was much loved. And Teddy Roosevelt thought it was a bully, and so did Woodrow Wilson. However, William James, who I've always been very fond of, if for no other reason because I love his idea of dividing people into tough-minded and tender-minded, thought they were kind of disgusting, and plebby and proly, and Sinclair Lewis, who wrote Babbitt, thought they were babbity. He didn't use the word babbity, but he basically thought they were babbity. So tonight, we've had a Chautauqua, and I'm the lecturer. I had a farm in Africa, and from that opening line, from out of Africa, you know that Isaac Dinesen will lose that farm. Tragedy will ensue, but a good story would unfold. So when I say I had a gig writing a companion book to a TV series, it is both an homage to and an echo of Dinesen. And it's like that moment in Mouse where Art Spiegelman's father stand-in says, "And then my troubles really began." The project was a coffee table book on sex and technology. To create the book, I had to make big picture editorial decisions predicated on what I hoped would be an okay compromise between market prudence and writer intuition. We all know that what you leave out is as important as what you put in, and that editing in the grandest sense is essential to the creation of anything. The biggest editorial choice came after looking at the videos of the TV series, which were almost entirely content-free. A segment on gender reassignment surgery? Nah, why bother? That species of surgery has been around since before I was born, and since my task was not to write a popular history of medicine, I decided I didn't really care about the meaningful, though gradual, advances in microsurgery, and that the real breakthrough, that of a prosthetic penis that works like a fleshy one does, hasn't happened yet. Advertorials on perfumes hypothetically based on pheromones, or on dermatologists whose makeup artistry is as good as plastic surgery, and getting clients to conform to pseudo-sociobiological come Hollywood models of mate-worthy superiority, I wasn't getting paid well enough to do advertising copywriting. Perhaps the most confusing episode was something about Japan, where, quote, "shopping, electronics, and sex, which characterizes society, are clearly where our future is heading." My takeaway was that the producer of this segment was enamored of how the Japanese women, as depicted, giggled good-naturedly when being sexually humiliated and were lighthearted about sex motels and extramarital affairs. And so the producer was making a futurist social trend out of his particular kink. All I could think of was the throwback line to my life in the 1980s when I was the lowest possible editorial unit at a McGraw-Hill technical trade publication. People would pitch the editorial staff story ideas on all manner of hardware, software, and services, and we were trained to say, quote, "but what does this have to do with data communications?" end quote. So what did any of what I saw on that TV show have to do with sex and technology? So with the go-ahead from my editor, I decided to do my own explicit but non-pornographic coffee table book on sex and technology. The most important editorial choice in service of this book was the decision to not to try to write an entire history of sex and technology. I'm not a historian like Rachel Manns, who wrote that groundbreaking feminist technology history of the vibrator, and putting together such a comprehensive project would require years. The idea, after all, was to come up with a coffee table book and not the equivalent of the physician's desk reference. In a publishing landia, a coffee table book means about 30,000 words and around 200 images, snapshots, verbal and pictorial, rather than an encyclopedia. Sex and technology is filtered through the way we live today, today being roughly the last 5 to 10 years. What would go into the book would be what I found interesting, not what I thought would be titillating to a hypothetical someone. The second decision revolved around the artwork. concerned with not perturbing the buyers for the big book chains, yet wanting to get into non-traditional retail outlets like Urban Outfitters, and realizing no how could a book compete with the XXX material available on the net that we all confront whether we want to or not, I decided the artwork would be all rated R and be suggestive, not explicit. Mood art and indirection better conform to my aesthetic anyway. As I began to do my researches, what the book would be about suggested itself, self-organizing out of chaos and nothingness. Viagra had to be in there, because I considered a true triumph of technology in service of sex. For the first time ever, there exists a real-life aphrodisiac. And in delving into this topic, there turned out to be many, many interesting bits. Everything from how the Church of England made a tidy $5 million from a timely investment in Pfizer, to Viagra use being strongly correlated with STDs and methadone use, according to public health clinics in San Francisco, to how it has led to the breakup of long-term marriages. The wife may have resigned herself to doing without sex because her husband couldn't engage anymore, but how does she feel when he discovers Viagra and turns to others for his affectional needs? Humiliated, that's how. And it's easy for a biochemist to tell from their structure some basic things about the big three erectile dysfunction drugs. That Levitra is obviously a copycat drug, different enough solely at the margins to get around IP issues. But Cialis, coming out of a biotech startup in part funded by Bill Gates, has the markings of a molecule assembled through computational chemistry and is different enough in molecular architecture that it performs in better and other means than the famous blue pill. Then there is a lot to write on the subject of hardware, variously defined. Talking to manufacturers of vibrators and dildos led to the delightful discovery that there are a multiplicity of issues that, well, were like consumer products creation and engineering challenges present in most lines of business. Trade-offs between noise and power, between the convenience of cordless and the reliability of the plug-in. The tension du jour between the boutique high-end domestic manufacturers and the cheap offshore mass producers with abysmal environmental and worker health and safety practices. The woman who popularized sparky-colored silicone dildos talked to me about how since silicone, a more biologically inert substance than the unsavory plastics used in most sex toys, is tricky to work with, so she wasn't too concerned about cheap Chinese knockoffs of her wares. The same confidence and craft was expressed by the creator of Real Dolls. The Asian knockoffs of his Love Dolls didn't even come close in terms of artisanal and functional excellence. On the other hand, when the dildo maker was considering adding vibrators to her dildos, she was torn between using higher quality Japanese vibrators, which might adversely affect her price points, versus El Cheapo ones from elsewhere. In an industry that is increasingly more consumer-driven and female, as opposed to frat boy of all ages driven, an emphasis on quality and durability is coming to matter. Hence the short-term domestic panic when it appeared a few years back that the sturdy, classic Hitachi magic wand would no longer be distributed in the U.S. But as with the rest of the consumer products industry, and the microelectronics industry in particular, the sex toy biz is still very price sensitive. The classic rabbit pearl vibrator made more famous by Sex and the City is a harbinger of the quality direction this branch of consumer electronics industry is heading. The idea for it came from a single Japanese engineer and was a triumph of consumer-oriented product creation. Prototypes were tested iteratively on Japanese housewife volunteers until the much-beloved vibrator reached its final form. Photographs were taken of the celebration of the engineer's achievement. Then there are the health and safety issues. Phthalates, the endocrine-disrupting plasticizers now banned in general in the EU and in the US from stuff coming into contact with babies, are pretty much in all sex toys. Some of the higher-end sex toys, such as the rabbit pearl, are now coming in a phthalate-free version, akin to how some products at the grocery store are labeled GMO-free. The problem is, as a polymer scientist at UCLA told me when I asked him some material science question, is that there is no guarantee that any elastomer will end up being any safer than the nasty phthalates. And no, sex toys are not regulated at all. They are novelties, after all. And even though the standard warning is given out at the clean, well-lighted place for sex toys, that a condom should be used with all toys, we all know people don't even do this with their human partners, where the more concrete risks of pregnancy and STDs are always present, and not the more distant ones of cancer 20 years from now. And in practice, there's little good that can be said about Monprene, the nasty compound that composes cyberskin, a trendily soft material used most notably in the Fleshlight, a butch, industrial-looking sex toy for men that features an aperture shaped like your choice of anus or vulva, molded in beautiful periwinkle cyberskin, that melts when exposed to heat, gets tacky easily, and can't easily be cleaned, and caused fires at one point in the plant where it was manufactured. It rapidly became apparent that if I weren't careful, the book could devolve into my big book of vibrators or a whole earth catalog for such. Boring! And not my charter. So in my attempt to diversify potential sources of useful art, I was initially drawn to the Flash Gordon-y four-color reproductions of CAT scans and MRIs of brains and genitalia as these body parts go through their cycles of excitation and deflation. But after a while, it made sense that a book on sex and technology should actually include some text written in its own right about the nifty, keen, technology-aided new research into how sex actually works in humans. I got to find out fun facts like, yes, for women, there ain't likely ever going to be the equivalent of Viagra, for the mechanisms of their arousals are complex and brain-centered rather than the more local and linear. I was also amused when a Stanford medical researcher attempting to model biological patterns of arousal remarked that it was hard to find sexually active female undergraduates at Stanford who hadn't had at least one sexual experience with another female. For reasons of injecting reasonable controls into her study and making sure her subjects would be aroused by the standardized visual and auditory stimuli she threw at them, the researcher needed a strongly heterotopic population. I'm not sure if this says that the young women who are likely to volunteer for sex research studies are more sexually flexible than the young men who volunteer, but collecting trivia like this was part of the fun of the project. And then there were really old-fashioned Lisa Lerbner-like girl nerd joy of discovery in working on the book. A case in point, it turns out that women also have PDE5 throughout their genitalia, the same enzyme that in penises is responsible to Viagra. The problem is, different women have it distributed to different degrees in different areas, which it goes at least part of the way towards explaining why women can vary so wildly in terms of what gives them pleasure and what doesn't. Finding out this stuff made it possible to drop into dinner party conversations, where appropriate, authoritative-sounding mini-rants that began, "Let me explain why Pfizer pulled the plug on its researchers to find a female version of Viagra." But even though I was compiling what felt like good data as no one had before, and I was definitely engaging in full-tilt intellectual rompitude, meta questions began emerging from the murk. For one, since there was clearly so much territory here, I wondered why no one had ever written a book on sex and technology in a tone that was descriptive and not prescriptive, with an ethos of entertainment but no leering. As far as I could tell at the beginning of the project, no one had, though a few books of more limited scope have come out since. The best explanation I could come up with was that most of the people who had ever written on these subjects were propagandists, advocating for sex and advocating for sex devices, or were writing guidebooks, or with intent to arouse. In other words, their rhetoric was suasory, persuasive, or epideictic, praising, either directly or indirectly, and not primarily forensic, telling the truth of what happened. It would be if no one outside the automobile industry had ever written about cars. The pointers provided by the folks I talked to in the sex world were invaluable, but to an outsider, the insistence that the Venus of Willendorf was clearly a sex toy, ouch, or that Neolithic objects on display in museums of anthropology as tent pegs were clearly butt plugs, more ouch, was strange. Hanging out with these folks and reading the literature they pointed me to was like being around any ideologue, no matter how friendly, a Marxist, a Jungian, a member of the Christian right. These folks, thanks be to their own special cognitive filters, always find what they are looking for in almost any human act. But being an outsider to this mechanistic view of sex that finds sex and sex machines in everything and plumps for it, at times felt like being an agnostic secular humanist around a member of Agnus Dei. The second scene's abominations of or the hand of God everywhere. The first sees a world far more mundane, but various, and often one with no trace of either good or evil. But from my reaction against the necessity of associating a propagandist mindset with a sexually informed mindset came still more unanswered questions. Clearly, humans have always been engineers. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, the Great Walls of China, the water wheels of medieval England. So, no surprise, I found at the Bancroft Library photos of ivory dildos made for the wives of merchants in 17th century Japan and pedal-powered dildos from the Weimar Republic. And humans have, in spite of occasional cultural fictions to the contrary, always been in favor of sex. In fact, humans are pretty much like the rest of their pals in the animal kingdom. As Susan McCarthy, author of When Elephants Weep, The Emotional Lives of Animals and Becoming a Tiger, How Baby Animals Live in the Wild, says, quote, apes have been spotted crafting sex toys on occasion, and I have a vague notion that a porcupine in the throes of longing may get improper with a branch. So one of the unanswered questions was, why is there so little good engineering in this industry sector? One may be shipping somewhere close to $100 billion a year. Though who knows, because with the exception of the Spanish global porn conglomerate Private and the pioneering feminist sex-positive German company Beata USA, almost none of the manufacturers are public companies, and the U.S. Department of Commerce doesn't track the trade. With the exception of Real Dolls and the Rabbit Pearl, both name-brand market leaders, almost nothing struck me as solid or admirable. With a happy marriage of form and function you could admire anywhere, that good engineers or good industrial designers have given real thought to a real problem. In the realm of sex machineries, things fall apart, look dumb, are cheesy, are noisy. Yes, there are very pricey, arty sex toys sold by Myla.com, Myla being a Brit Victoria's Secret meets Good Vibrations combo, objet d'art designed by Philip Starkish name-brand designers, such as those that have their merchandise at Target, or whose furnishings for the home are featured on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. Such things are also merchandised in catalogs pitched at women looking to make purchasing decisions about 90% organic cotton, 10% lycra, yoga wear imprinted with their spiritual affirmations. But these highly designed sex toys for women are mass-market luxury goods for the status insecure, instantiations of what I call design schmime. Design whose unconscious intent is to show off to other designers how fashion-forward the designers are, but don't reveal any deep problem-solving mentation or ingenuity. You look at these toys and have the reaction of, huh? But what do they do, aside from possibly look decorative on the bedside table in a hotel room designed by Andre Putnam? The spirit of Henry Dreyfuss or Edward Pulaski or the unknown industrial designer behind the irreplaceably wonderful Swiss Hermes typewriter of the 1960s, sci-fi William Gibson loves them too, is almost nowhere in the realm of sex toys. It's damn peculiar because it's a truism in the history of technology that sex is so often driven innovation. It's well known that sex industry players fostered the use of VHS as opposed to beta as the standard for home video, and online porn purveyors fostered the development of e-commerce and broadband to the home. But sex hardware is at best trailed along behind existing technologies. The widget that makes a vibrator vibrate came from the vibrator technology that was developed to put cell phones in their polite vibrate mode. The slightest touch, a sex tape marketed solely for women, repackages a $5 TENS, which stands for transcutaneous electronic nerve stimulator, unit that's been around for years and is sold over the counter for folks with soft tissue pain, such as repetitive stress injury. The gizmo works by slapping electrode pads above each female ankle, and the unit closes the circuit somewhere in the realm of the pelvis. For some women, this heightens pleasure, no crime in that. The crime is that more than $100 is charged for the device, and it basically rebrands a technology that's been around for a long time and that's been known in electric play circles for years. A more troubling unanswered question was about the depth and breadth of this intersection of instrumentality and sex. That this intersection has become so mainstream that Cosmo can have as one of its cover lines a feature on, quote, your most embarrassing vibrator moments, unquote. Is this a function of the technology finally having caught up with basic human experience, analogous to how modern dentistry is finally good enough to save most people's teeth, mostly painlessly? Or is it because we live in such a technology-saturated society, one of endlessly mediated experience, that the complexities of human sexuality are thought to be resolved by simply throwing some technology at the problem? Do we as sexual beings want to model ourselves on how automation and all its modes have diminished headcounts and human interaction in too many areas of human endeavor to count? Intimacy is hard. Unearned intimacy, as with a multiple choice question, database, aspects of online dating, as with the Excel spreadsheets downloadable into a PDA of ranked attributes and skills of sex workers, as with the fucking machine's porn site, where guys watch machines having intercourse with women, so the male voyeur doesn't have to acquire a female partner. He doesn't even have to do the work of identifying with a human male, bringing the phallic extension to the act. All this, at first glance, are superior heuristics. Emotional scaredy-catness, I guess, has become a la mode. Technology, here, there, and everywhere, is held out for the cure for incommunicativeness with or incompatibility with a partner, laziness with a partner, lack of a partner, bed death, and a million other psychosexual trickinesses. Lumping together real dolls and fucking machines and the thrill hammer, guys pay money to use a joystick to remotely manipulate a dildo being thrust into a model sex worker. With on-our-backs type approved vibrators and dildos, they all have in common a bias that the technological and the repeatable is preferable to the eccentric, erratic, error-bound, and human. Our culture at large deviates towards the whizzy, the game-boxy, the microprocessor-embedded, and the synthetic, so should our sex lives be any different? Evidence along these lines came in the unexpected responses I got when I asked folks, friends and professional contacts, I talked to in the course of the project to send me any images or photos they came across that might work in the book. More than 90% of what my friendly helpers and acquaintances sent me were BDSM, dominatrixy-looking leather vinyl fetish girls. I would look at these images, and unbidden, what would come to mind would be something along the lines of, yes, but what does this have to do with data communications? So after thanking the people who pointed me at these images, I'd ask them, what does this have to do with sex and technology? Where's the technology in this picture? True, there is the well-known spike of BDSM role-playing hoo-ha in the geek community, but most folks outside of high tech don't know of that correlation. Is it that our feelings about sexuality and our feelings about technology have gotten so mashed up that they've unnaturally merged in the unconscious into a single gestalt of domination? It simply didn't make any sense. And not to mention, it once again made that tired default assumption that the viewer or reader was a het male, or perhaps a lesbian, into power games, thus excluding, 60% or more of the population from the gaze. And the offerers of these useless but well-intended gift images will be sheepish and speechless and not really be able to tell me why they sent me those pictures or why they thought they were apt. This, of course, about the instrumentality-sexuality interlock forced me to confront a lot of my prejudices. Pervert that I am, I'd always thought sex was about an interesting psychological exchange with another human being, and was that inner sanctum where one felt most human. But perhaps I was a paraphiliac in a category of my own, and hadn't realized until I worked on the book how much in the sexual minority I was. To me, the prime directive to mechanize that most non-rational, and each time is a different time thrill of human experience, didn't necessarily make sense at all. And as a corollary, I began to wonder how much to most folks sex and masturbation were mostly equivalent, where I'd always found them to be distinctly different spheres of human activity and emotion. And a part of this discombobulated inquiry into the idea that maybe everything I thought I knew about sex is wrong, I began to wonder if perhaps the experience I thought was a human universal, that with some sex partners and in some contexts, no matter what is essayed, nothing enjoyable is going to take place. Yet with other partners or in some other context, it takes little more than the stroking of a cow-licking eyebrow for uproarious good times to ensue. Was not like what everyone else felt, too. That is, maybe extreme sensitivity to original conditions wasn't a common denominator in human sexuality, though I'd always thought it was. Another troubling question arose, one that assaulted what I would call my aging Berkeley feminist orientation, and at times would make me feel like I was linking arms with sister spirits Andrea Dworkin, Camille Paglia, and Catherine McKinnon, a sorority I never wanted to join. And what I mean by aging Berkeley feminist orientation is a mindset that says, men and women are more alike than not, men are people too, along certain axes that tend to be ignored often, just as women are too, again along certain other axes often ignored, that there's a spectrum of gendered behaviors with both men and women showing up at every point, And certainly the intersex and transgender communities have informed our understanding of what's male and what's female and what's cultural and what's innate and how they all mysteriously intertwine. No, this mindset of mine is fiercely free speech. Fine. But as I kept on doing my research, I kept on having the nagging feeling that what might be considered the worst of guy-like behavior in the stereotypical sense, an emphasis on tools and rules and things that can be regularized and an avoidance of the psychological and the interpersonal. So technosexuality, a paraphilia of folks fantasizing about sex with androids and robots, is, according to the fellow who runs the Master Technosexuality website, a preoccupation that attracts a population more than 90% male. These attitudes were being potentiated. There's that song, Dance, Tan, Looks, Three, from A Chorus Line, with a dancer more into being not only being reduced to a number, but being judged more on her tits and ass than her skill. I was similarly creeped out by what I took to calling online zagat guides to escorts, that is, websites where all body parts, participation in, and skills at sexual activity and emotions. Did she give you the girlfriend or honeymoon experience? Was she friendly and outgoing? Did she give good conversation? Were given numeric rankings. The women were truly being reduced to a kind of product comparison chart you can find in consumer reports, conveniently ignoring that what one person finds beautiful or erotically engaging will leave another cold. But the pervasive idea that sexuality can be reduced to numbers and technique, or the well-worn trope of women being like cars or like machines that can be hacked so they'll put out, the whole player how to pick up girls ickiness. With all due respect to Donna Haraway's cyborg manifesto about how none of us ain't natural human beings anymore anyway, it was hard to shake the impression that the canonical worst parts of one gender were being nourished, picked up on, and spread out culture-wide. When I worked around the fringes of the corporate world in the 80s, it was the era of power suits and dressing for success and games your mother never taught you and women truly feeling they needed to not be like women in order to get on the big bad world of business. Now, things in the business world are both more fluid and as bad as always. Think Larry Dowd and Maureen Dowd and Larry Summers. But as always, it was troubling to me that what we considered to be unpleasantly cliched male behaviors were what one had to ape in order to get on. Porn, for example, is so pervasive on the web that it's almost not worth remarking on it. And the web and the net have made it so much a default part of our lives that I don't even have much of a startle response anymore when I get spam that consists of solicitations for kiddie porn or featured doing violence for women. Two recent books, Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture, and Pornified, How Pornography is Transforming Our Lives and Our Relationships and Our Families, talk in part about the delirious effects of pervasive net porn and het relationships, how it changes for the worse how these pornophilic men view their partners and their relationships with their partners. Quote, I don't see that any man who loves porn can think actual sex is better, at least if it involves the crap that goes along with having a real-life female in your life, unquote. Men who belong to Real Dolls user groups say similar things. Depersonalization and the removal of unsettling human complication are the default orders of the day, and it makes one uneasy to consider how both advances in technology and technophilia aren't exactly pro-women. I can't buy that engaging in sexual competition with a screen fantasy or turning yourself into an object, unless doing so is of particular erotic interest to you, or holding up as a beau ideal the vaunted endless variety, but ultimately endless repetition, compulsion, monotony of porn is a feminist idea, however you define feminist. But looking beyond porn, particularly with the paradoxical civil liberties issues it raises for a hardcore free speech nut like myself, and musing on just what was bugging me in the worldview I was being exposed to day after day in my researches, I conducted what my homie Wittgenstein might call a thought experiment. Imagine, if you will, what it would be like if technology were enabling what might be considered the worst of stereotypical female behaviors. Let's say the collecting of white wicker dollhouse furniture and the owning of pictures of kittens were considered necessary courtship rituals for het men, and there was a forced collective cultural acceptance of the Harlequin romance or bodice ripper as the model of ideal relationships, and all men were expected to look and act like a mixture of Fabio and Ashley Wilkes, and spend all their time at work pondering new opportunities to spring nosegays of violets on their mates, and should weekly take time off from their lunch hours to accompany their mates on shopping trips to Bergdorf's, platinum Amex in hand, and write long poems and letters processing their feelings towards their mates, who are stay-at-home moms with four kids, a nanny, a maid, a personal assistant, and an active life as a social climber. Our imaginary males, technology-enabled for females, would gladly convert their home workshops into studios where their mates could work on their scrapbooking, and would be ecstatic to crawl into bed every night in a room filled with pink ruffles, stuffed animals, dolls, sachet, potpourri, and lacy throw pillows. These male avatars would make $1 gazillion per year, but would always be home for all possible familial demands, ranging from middle school piano recitals to playing garde-manger at their mates' in-home fundraising teas. And oh, they would never dream of taking vacations without the kids and their mothers-in-law, preferably the locales where one of their mates' siblings live. These figments of the female emotion porn imagination would have no say in the rearing of the kids, what would be expected to contribute one half of the domestic duties after having written all the checks for the household. In other words, imagine if technology were dictating that men should be nothing more than part ambulatory sperm banks, part ATM machines, part male mommies, and as lacking in individuality, three-dimensional human character, and the impulse towards personal gratification as any porn bunny. Scary, eh? So with the thrill hammer coming ever closer to the dream of teledildonics and soccer moms buying vibrators for their college-bound daughters, it appears that the traditional guy values have colonized sex, the values that say that sex isn't about the personal but the mechanical. The bar is lowered, the zeitgeist is coarsened, and it's hard to believe that the volume of authentic human joy has gone up for either men or women because of it. Sociologist Philip Slater prophetically talked about the depersonalizing addiction to technology in his classic 1970, The Pursuit of Loneliness. And so did E.M. Forster. Yes, that E.M. Forster, in his 1909 sci-fi short story, The Machine Stops, said, quote, "Men seldom move their bodies. All unrest was concentrated in the soul," unquote. There's really little new in this critique of technology, that it can lead to itemization and balkanization, that it kind of caters to a fear of the intricacy of human interrelationship. But it was kind of stunning to observe how readily it penetrated a broader cultural sensibility about sex, which in my strictly myopic, bigoted opinion is exactly yummy, yet rich and creamy, precisely because it is multivalent, undefinable, and so deeply unalgorithmic and personal. To me, the technique uber alles attitude towards sexuality gives off vibes as upsetting and toxic and crypto anti-woman as, say, the leftover Freudian attitudes of another decade, where, in speech acts worthy of homicidal attack by Kate Millett, the esteemed psychoanalytically oriented culture critic Ernest Becker could write his Pulitzer Prize-winning The Denial of Death, featured a comic effect in a 1970s Woody Allen movie, about how a male fears the power of his mother, and by extension all women, because he never gets over thinking what a witch she is after seeing his first toilet bowl full of menstrual blood. And of course, women have penis envy, because all they can create is a dead, inert stool in contrast to a vibrant, life-affirming erection. I don't know what kind of home life Becker had as a child, and I probably don't want to know. But to me, his early 60s feminist backlash fantasy rationalizations were just that, bunkum in defense of social structures that were female-unfriendly. I'm always wary of justifications for what appears to be attacks on our finer feelings and are trumpeted as the ways things really are and or statements of progress that are so often curiously anti-woman in the traditional sense. It's just dismaying how in each new generation, there's an au courant cultural iteration bent on diminishing women, as in the 80s, it was aerobics that was the new corset. There were many days after working on the project I felt, A, I never wanted to have sex again. B, if I did have sex again, it couldn't be with a guy, because they were, as a group, frightening, and other, not in a good way. And C, I'd never find anyone to have sex with, because clearly my fuddy-duddy humanistic model of sex, that it's about intimacy, marked me as a Six Sigma freak out of tune with a larger culture. I also knew that the troubling questions the research was raising could not be put into a book. It was, after all, a fun coffee table book, and unlike my previous book, was not intended to throw me out once again smack into argument culture and provoke debate and name-calling. Controversy doesn't necessarily sell books, in spite of what you hear, and it is exhausting for the unintentional creator of it. I did have folks tell me that they did want to read what, in a sense, would have been the outtakes, director's cut of the book. That is, they were interested in what conclusions I'd really come to through the researches. And that's what this Chautauqua lecture tonight is for. But as I keep telling these friends and acquaintances who did seem interested in the behind the music, making of the coffee table book, Wired for Sex, Sex Technology and the Way We Live Today, there's no market for such writing, and I'm not a blogger. And having been the loyal opposition house critic for technology culture in the 1990s, I wasn't interested in recapping the role. That the ethos of throw a vibrator at it seems to be not the best solution for sexual dysfunction. It's a quick fix, and potentially elides, avoids foundational problems, puts me in a minority position. And taking on the whole sex-positive establishment, who were so generous with their time and resources as I was working on the book, wasn't something I wanted to do. Besides, arguing with people's feelings doesn't usually get you anywhere. The paradox I couldn't resolve, and that I still can't as I stand here tonight, is how to reconcile the exuberant animal nature that leads to homo faber and homo ludens, which always likes to make stuff and damn straight also likes sex, with the sense that there's something currently going on that is out of whack, extreme, and pushing us to accommodate ourselves to machine epistemologies, what I elsewhere termed the software way of knowledge. So what are my net bottom line end of the day conclusions about what I learned from the project? They are: there's a lot of money to be made if someone brought good sense and good art to the sex industry, because there's so little of either. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on at the intersection of sex and technology, but no one is really documenting this in a comprehensive but neutral fashion. What we can learn from machines and software isn't the stuff that bitchy apply to sexuality. So any questions? And since this is a Chautauqua and I'm your lecturer tonight, I really will take questions from people if they have any. If you don't, that's fine. This wasn't billed as an audience participation thing, so. Yes?
You. What is your next project?
Let's see. I will try not to be profane. I'm not sure. I have ideas.
I love to see a technology.
I think that's been done a lot of times. So.
What's your website?
It's eponymous.
So you didn't talk about illegality, you didn't talk about the questions of legality, right?
Legality in what sense?
You touched on it, actually. You said you were a fundamentalist free speech person, and yet, you know, there have been people going to jail over bulletin boards, and somehow net policy is supposed to be determined by kitty porn. What did you see in the intersection of law, sex, and...
I wasn't looking at it because I was thinking coffee table book. You know, and there are lots of policy books written on this stuff, and it's a moving target, and there's the community standards issue, and the fact that all this stuff is offshore anyway, so enforcement is futile. So I was really trying to stay away from that because I thought, what's fun to read? What would make pretty pictures? I had everything. We had, like, first-person interviews with the guy... I had a wonderful first-person interview from the guy who invented the Real Dolls, and he actually was an artist, and he created the first Real Dolls, an art project, and he just took a video of it, of one of them sitting on his couch next to him. It was an art project. There was nothing sexual in it. It was just a very realistic-looking woman, and so we got email from people who'd seen his webcam going, is that anatomically correct? And he had worked as a mask maker, making like Halloween masks, and he got to know a lot of the old kind of special effects people in Hollywood, and so he basically turned this into a wonderful cottage industry, literally out of his garage in Orange County, and his family's employed, and he's really proud of what they've created, and they're like in Rev 12.2 of the endoskeleton. I mean, this to me was the interesting stuff, was the human stories behind all this stuff. It wasn't to me the titillation factor, because I can't speak for what will turn who on. And I also felt it was really possible to talk about this in a rated R way, that you could have wonderful pictures of the Real Dolls, of the vibrators, or one of the pictures that's flown by I really love. It's the output onto an oscilloscope of, I think, the slightest touch. You know, you can see the waveform. So I was really looking at what's aesthetically interesting. I wasn't looking at what's going to give you a hot time, because how would I know? And everybody is so different. And even Rachel Manns, the historian of technology who wrote that book on vibrators in the 19th century, even she tends to be kind of dictatorial. I mean, she will say, all women like this. And I feel like saying, and you know this how? I mean, there tends to be a really kind of spooky overgeneralization, I think, in this world. But it would really surprise me when I did the research that no one else had ever written about this in this very neutral, I don't want to call it, but neutral way, if that makes sense. Oh, please.
What do you think of those young people these days? They're doing it.
Well,
the Stanford.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the soccer moms buying the vibrators for their daughters going off to college. I don't know. I mean, I have to bring, first of all, young people today are growing up in a so much more sexualized culture. I mean, it's so pervasive. It's so everywhere. It's kind of unavoidable. But my, I think, I guess, very unevolved and repressive view of sexuality is part of what the function of sexuality is it's that thing which you really are differentiated from your parents. It's a private space they don't know anything about, hopefully, and you do it off on your own, and they didn't take you to lessons three times a week from the time you were nine, and it's your own thing. And it's a little disturbing to me that the soccer mom buying the vibrator for their daughter, it's sort of like a creepy kind of helicopter parent thing. It's like they shouldn't be invading that as well, because what other private space do you have if you're not your sex life? So I observe that, and I think, boy, that would creep me out if I were a kid. But I'm not growing up now. I'm sort of watching all of this, and so that's what I think about it. And you grow up with it being taken for, you know, it's everywhere, it's pervasive. Yet we have this strange puritanical thing going with the Christian right at the same time, and this kind of piety about the children. So, you know, how do you reconcile what goes on in a video game with kind of this child, you know, falsely child worshiping culture? So I can't answer it outside of a larger cultural context. But of course, I never want to argue with what people like, but I had a definite creep out factor in this whole thing. I really would come home and go, guess what I found out today? So, yeah, just that.
I don't think this has to do with technology exactly, but it has to do with modernity.
Okay.
In the last 50 years, we've had a kind of a crossing in that real world body shapes have become more and more obese, but sexualized body image become sort of more and more sort of petite and sculpted. And
well, I would say robot-y looking, android-y looking, harder, you know, buffed and cut, I would say.
I mean, that seems to kind of be presenting a problem in that for people to fulfill what's going on in their head,
yeah,
the real world seems like it becomes harder and harder. And does it seem like people are turning more and more to either pornography or sort of fetishized images or whatever as a way of distracting themselves or resolving that?
Well, possibly, but this is part of, a larger thing about modernity, is that if you just do something like look at fashion magazines from the 50s compared to now, again, the bodies were beautiful, but the bodies looked much more human. They didn't have this machine age quality to them. You know, they just looked softer. Even the kind of the facial structure was softer and didn't have this almost, I would say, and I use the word, you know, kind of, the word is thrown around too much, but a kind of a fascist aesthetic of, you know, person is machine. And you look at that, fashion magazines, or even if you look at like movies from the 30s versus movies now, the bodies look more cyborgy than they did. And that's held up more of the model of what you want to look like. So it's not just the obesity thing. It's like, what do we consider attractive? What do we think of as compelling as a sexual object? And it is not the soft squishiness that, you know, your average lab cat has. And before, we were all kind of like lab cats in a way. You know, there were curves and things.
They often look more predatory.
Yeah.
Predatory of instinct becomes sexualized.
Well, as I sort of said, the domination thing seems to have kind of gone everywhere. And I was so puzzled that for years, people would send me these pictures, and I go, where's the technology in this picture? But somehow technology, domination, sex all mushed together. And, you know, Jung says that all repressed functions get mushed together. So I guess all those functions have got mushed together. I mean, I'm just an observer. I'm not describing anything or I'm not telling people what to do. I'm just describing. You can ask me questions about the images if you're interested in any of the images. I know they've flown by pretty quickly, or maybe you don't want to know. Yes?
Just one little comment on the popularity of dominance images.
Yeah.
I forever lost whatever personal interest I had in that area when I read the greatest column by Catherine Miskowski entitled Nerverts.
Oh, yeah, that's a great column.
Computer people like this stuff so much, and the answer was it's algorithmic and it's rule-based.
That's right.
At that point, I happened to have lost interest, but
yeah, it was a great column, and I think that that's true, because again, it's all about, I don't feel comfortable with my own sexuality, I'm not sure anyone would want to screw me anyway, but if we follow these protocols, we can do the handshaking. So, right, so, well, this definitely does, and I will, a true confessions thing here, I was invited to a party once where there were a lot of those people there, no names, but there were a lot of those people there. And I can't imagine how anybody would have sex with any of them. Let's just put it that way. So I thought, oh, I see, this all makes sense. So if you dress up and, you know, in your Dungeons and Dragons outfit and hit each other over the head with dead hamsters, then, you know, maybe you can get something going. But, you know, it seemed so much like a simulacrum of a facsimile of a copy of a vaguely palimpsest, partly decoded something of what a human sexual interaction might be or how attraction might work and stuff. And I thought, well, okay, works for them. Can I leave now? So, so you're probably all hot and bored. So is that it, or do you have any other questions? Well, thank you for coming to our Chautauqua.